This is St. Louis Public Radio. Picture this. Dozens of gay men gather for a pool party in a secluded spot in Hillsboro, Missouri. Home movies capture their easy affection and carefree dancing. But these aren't recent videos. These movies were taken in 1945. 50 years later, a young St. Louis man named Jeff Story stumbled upon the films. Now he's weaving them into a documentary about a time when being openly, publicly gay would most certainly cost you your job and maybe even your life. St. Louis Public Radio's Nancy Fowler reports the project offers a rare glimpse into a largely invisible world.
Filmmaker Jeff Story and Susie Seagraves of Wentzville are leaning over the kitchen counter, looking at a photo of a man wearing a Speedo swimsuit.
You'd get a kick out of this picture.
Seagraves is talking about her late uncle Buddy. Buddy Walton was once known as St. Louis's hairdresser to the stars, from Eleanor Roosevelt to Ethel Merman. Whenever celebrities and dignitaries came to town, they all went to Walton's salon at the Chase.
Queens and president's wives and movie stars. He was always around fancy places and fancy things, and he had a beautiful life.
Filmmaker Jeff Story stepped into that life when he went to an estate sale 20 years ago at Buddy Walton's mansion on Lindell Boulevard. In the attic, he found two reels of color film from 1945.
And the title slide said, a gay party. I thought,
Story was intrigued by his discovery. Years later, he began weaving the films into a documentary. As a gay man, he finds them especially compelling.
The end of one of the reels, there's a man in uniform that approaches another man and kisses him on the mouth very passionately. And there was such a beauty in that moment. I kind of couldn't believe I was seeing it.
Story began a jagged journey to find anyone who is in the films who might still be living. He's located some relatives like Seagraves, but he says most of the men at the pool that day are probably dead. Several people who aren't in the home movies can testify to what it was like to be gay in mid-century St. Louis, like Richard Eaton, who grew up in the 1940s. I went to his home in Soulard to talk about the past and look at photos.
Come on in.
Eaton, who's 78, has always had pets, but early on, he couldn't even imagine having a partner, much less a husband, only flings. He used to look over his shoulder as he ventured to gay bars like Martin's near Union Station.
There were a couple places that had like the old speakeasies. You know, they would open the sliding door to see who was out there before they would open the door.
But it wasn't just going out to the bars. Even the prospect of getting medical care was fraught with peril.
So I went to my new doctor. But one of the first questions he asked me was, have I had any sexual experiences with other men? And I lied. You know, I didn't know what he would do with the information because he was new.
What do you think a person could do with that information?
At that time, I thought, well, would he call my employer?
Eaton worked at Ladue High School as a guidance counselor.
That's a Ladue picture. One of the years.
He shows me a 40-year-old photo taken during a time when he led a double life. To keep track, he only went by Richard in his social circle.
If somebody approached me and called me Rich, I knew that they were associated with the Ladue School District. And so that's how I kept my identity separate.
Something else that was kept separate, whites and people of color. Gay life, like all life in St. Louis, was segregated. The only African Americans in the pool party footage are wearing white uniforms, serving food to the other men.
Even, you know, in the gay world, there was still class, there was still race, there was still all those issues.
Beth Prusasik is working with Story as a co-director on the documentary. She says all kinds of privilege determined who attended these lavish pool parties, who got to enjoy this kind of freedom, likely denied to those who weren't wealthy white men.
When I first watched the movie, I noticed a number of the men have wedding rings on. And I thought, you know, these men have to go back to their lives where they can't be as, you know, open and can't be who they are. And that is even more significant for, you know, African-American men, lower class men.
The other people missing from the pool party were women. But 81-year-old Betty Neely says lesbians were having their own clandestine gatherings. Neely takes me to the basement of her Webster Groves home to show me a poster-size photo of herself in the 1950s. It's an iconic image of Neely that once hung in a local lesbian bar and shows her in her trademark leather jacket with her impressive set of wheels.
That's a 1952 K model, Harley-Davidson motorcycle, Sportster. And I'm outside of a bar on South Broadway, and I'm older than 16 because I'm on the street.
Neely says bars like the Kit Kat Club felt like the safest places to gather with friends.
People say to me, why didn't they have a house party? I said, oh, yeah, that's great. People next door complained to your landlord that you had 12 men-looking women in your house last night. The next day, I have to move.
Memories like that fascinate filmmaker Jeff Story. Back in the kitchen, Story and Susie Seagraves are going over numerous photos of Seagraves' gay uncle, Buddy Walton.
So, yeah, I definitely want any images of you of that time because
Story has come to believe that it was Walton behind the camera, filming those gay men at a pool party in 1945.
And these men are still in their 20s in the sun swimming, like they always will. And there's a real sweet pain. And when you watch it, there's a happiness. But you can't believe it's so long ago, and you can't touch it. It's gone.
The haunting images are confirmation that, yes, gay men did live and love at a time when no one dared to even speak of same-sex attraction.
Someone thought to turn on a camera, that these people allowed a camera into this sacred place. I just knew it was gold. It was something special.
Story says he has reason to believe his documentary, simply called Gay Home Movie, could make it big. It's caught the interest of Hollywood executive Brian Graydon, who in 1995 backed a film that launched the TV show South Park. I'm Nancy Fowler, St. Louis Public Radio.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. For years, going to a drag show meant watching men dressed as women perform. But as society has become more open to people expressing themselves in a variety of ways, so has the nature of the drag show. St. Louis Public Radio's Nancy Fowler reports on how today's drag scene encompasses many identities while also applauding the more traditional queen.
Once a month, 90-year-old John Chaney dons a blonde wig, a dressy suit and heels, and transforms into a Tammy Wynette lookalike.
Please welcome to the stage the first lady of country music, Miss Bonnie Blake. Give it up for her.
It's Saturday night, and against the shimmering silver and purple curtains at Bar PM on South Broadway, the Arkansas native sways back and forth while mouthing well-worn lyrics. Chaney, who's performed since the late 1950s, remembers vividly his first time on stage.
It brought the house down, and the girl that was running the show there, she said, Bonnie, how about coming back and Saturday and doing the show with us Saturday? I said, oh, yes, yes, okay. And I was hooked on it.
What Chaney was doing was illegal in Missouri. It was 1985 before state law allowed people to dress in drag. Now, drag kings routinely perform in suits and ties, sometimes with added facial hair, alongside the queens. Chaney gets that. But when others appear with both a beard and a skirt,
that's not drag, I don't think. That's my opinion.
It's witchcraft.
28-year-old Maxie Glamour identifies as genderqueer, uses the pronouns they and them, and goes by their stage name full-time. Forget the falsies, Glamour is proud to display their flat chest through the opening of a sparkly vest.
When I first started doing drag, I was like, well, I'm not exactly a woman, but I don't want to be a man either, and there wasn't the word non-binary. It was there, but no one used it.
Unlike Chaney, Glamour never knew a time when drag was illegal. But they have known discrimination as an African American and someone who places themselves under the transgender umbrella.
So how many of you guys are going to combat transphobia out there this holiday season?
Glamour mixes activism with polka-themed drag and burlesque at Das Bevo Performance Space on a recent Saturday night. Wearing a Viking helmet with pink feathers and their trademark demon ears, Glamour leads the crowd in the chicken dance.
when I'm performing and I'm, you know, doing booty pops and handstands, I don't have to worry about, like, oh, did I pay my cell phone bill? You know, if I forgot to floss that morning, or, and I don't have to worry about anything. Like, it's beautiful.
That kind of magic is something 90-year-old John Chaney, a.k.a. Bonnie Blake, knows well. When he really thinks about it, Chaney says there is room for everyone in drag, including those who don't make a choice between what's considered masculine or feminine attire.
Yeah, everybody, that's, if that's her bag, I say do it. It doesn't bother me at all. So get out
while you can. After all, Chaney says, few people understood why he performed dressed in traditional female clothing more than a half century ago. I'm Nancy Fowler, St. Louis Public Radio.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Each year, transgender individuals and allies in St. Louis celebrate Transgender Day of Visibility on March 31st. It's a day of support and recognizing achievements. For many, especially transgender seniors, just being themselves is a tremendous accomplishment. St. Louis Public Radio's Nancy Fowler visited with two older transgender women whose similar experiences marched in time with history. Don't sit under the apple tree
with anyone else but me. When 80-year-old Whisper Lowe of Belleville was growing up during World War II, society demanded patriotism and strict gender roles. Lowe was assigned male gender at birth. When she was five, her mother caught her putting on lipstick.
And her response was to smear the lipstick all around my mouth and then push me out onto the front porch where all the neighborhood kids were playing in the street, and locked the door.
After that, Lowe was more careful, occasionally trying on women's clothes in the attic, an urge that only grew stronger as she grew up. A successful military career followed, then marriage. But marriage didn't make the feelings go away.
3 weeks after the wedding, why, she discovered me in one of her dresses.
Lowe's wife refused to talk about it. But when Lowe was in her 40s, she went to see Masters and Johnson, national experts based in St. Louis.
They basically told me there was nothing wrong with me. And then I'd get with my wife, and she'd go on and on and on about how terrible and disgusting it was.
In recent years, Lowe's been slipping out of the house with a change of clothes to gather once a month with other transgender women.
The saddest time of all is having to take the nails off and the makeup off and change back into male clothing and go back to living as a man. City girl
with the red dress on. Shelley Richmond of Cahokia was born in the 1950s, an era that still expected rigid male and female roles. Like Lowe, Richmond always felt the male label didn't fit, but mom's girdle felt just right. At 4 years old, Richmond would shut the bathroom door, dig the girdle out of the hamper, and gaze into the full-length mirror.
In my mind, at that point in time, it was probably the most beautiful thing that I could wear.
For most of her life, Richmond lived as a boy, then a man, serving in the military, working at General Motors, getting married. After Richmond told her wife about the urges, she helped with the makeup and clothes, but only in private.
It was kind of like the movie The Danish Girl. You know, the spouse was looking at it kind of like a game.
But for Richmond, it was serious, a matter of identity. She made friends online with other transgender women. 2 years ago, at age 61, she began presenting as a woman at work. Inside her house, her childhood home, where she still lives today with her wife of 43 years, Richmond leads me down the hall to the bathroom. She looks into the very same mirror she once faced as a young child, wearing her mother's girdle.
It felt so good to be able to be that little girl, even for a little while.
What do you see when you look in that mirror now?
You know what? I a lot of times I see that little girl standing there staring back at me. Kind of a smile and a thumbs up type thing of you're going, you're there, you know, you're where you want to be.
I'm Nancy Fowler, St. Louis Public Radio.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Black History Month is a time to spotlight African Americans who made a difference. But many people don't know that some of these prominent African Americans were part of the LGBTQ community, like Bayard Rustin, an openly gay black man who worked side by side with Martin Luther King Jr. Here in St. Louis, though, the late civil rights strategist is honored every day at a storefront called Rustin's Place in the Vandeventer neighborhood. It's a drop-in center that largely serves LGBTQ people, particularly gay African American men. E. Rise Williams of St. Louis founded the center. St. Louis Public Radio's Nancy Fowler reports that Williams' own story also reveals important history about local gay black culture.
E. Rise Williams proudly shows me around Rustin's Place on Sarah Street between Page Boulevard and Vandeventer Avenue. The center offers health screenings and a chance to bond with other people during movie nights and meals.
Over here, we have like a kitchen area. We have Soul Food Sundays sometimes, so people would like do a potluck and bring some things.
People who are homeless can also bring their laundry. Against the swishing and bumping of the washer and dryer, Williams often talks with them about black gay history, including the story of the late Bayard Rustin.
And they can learn, oh, this is the guy who helped, you know, organized the March on Washington. He worked with Martin Luther King, and Martin Luther King knew he was gay, you know, and so all the negative messages that they may have heard, there's some positive messages out there too.
Williams' own life also offers a wealth of history lessons. The 52-year-old came out as a teenager in 1980. He remembers his very first trip to a black gay club called the Zebra Lounge on Olive Street.
When I went into the door, one of my favorite songs was playing. So I was like, okay, this is a sign. I'm supposed to be here. There's a new me coming
out. Being at the clubs was fun, but there was another side. Many gay bars seemed off limits to black men, at least most of the time.
Clubs like Magnolia's and Knights would have quote-unquote urban nights, you know, and that was just a code word for a black night. And, you know, the music would change and the white guys would start leaving and the black guys would come in.
The racial divide was evident not only in the bar scene, Williams says, but also in the misinformation that was being spread about the emerging HIV-AIDS crisis. At that time, no one understood the virus or how it was transmitted. In the black gay community, word on the street was,
don't have sex with white men, and don't have sex with black men who've had sex with white men. Because at that point in our country's history, HIV was mostly impacting white gay men.
But of course, it was just a myth that AIDS was a white, gay, male disease.
And I think because of that myth, that's probably why we weren't as proactive as we probably could have been and saved a lot more lives had we been.
Williams is talking about his work with a group called Blacks Assisting Blacks Against AIDS. For 12 years, he wrote grants and spoke to African Americans about HIV/AIDS. In 2004, he launched his own group with a similar mission. Williams and associates opened Rustin's Place 4 years later and moved it to its current location in 2013. HIV prevention and testing is still a big part of the center's outreach. Its broader goal, though, is to help clients take charge of their own lives.
This drop-in center is really part of an intervention that we have, and it's a core part of it, where we're trying to empower particularly young black gay men.
Williams would like to expand Rustin's Place to provide temporary housing for some of the hundreds of young gay black men who come for help every year. I'm Nancy Fowler, St. Louis Public Radio.